This is Judge Larkin. Good morning. The last case on the court's oral argument calendar this morning is Colson versus Bright Birch Incorporated. We're ready for arguments. We're doing this on the Zoom platform. I'm not sure if either of the attorneys has had an opportunity to participate in a Zoom hearing. The rules are the same. Each attorney will get 15 minutes for his primary argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal argument. At this point, I'll call on counsel for appellant to present argument. Please state your name for the record before doing so. Thank you.
Good morning, David McGee. May it please the court and counsel. I represent Travis Colson, who's the appellant in this matter. Mr. Colson is a real estate agent, and he was affiliated with brokerage Remax Advantage Plus. He also, while being affiliated with that brokerage, also became a team member. Teams are allowed under Minnesota statutes, basically affiliated with Bright Birch, which was a team also under the brokerage of Remax Advantage Plus. There was a team agreement entered into with Bright Birch and Mr. Colson in 2017. Now, sometime in 2018, Bright Birch decided that it no longer wanted to be affiliated with Remax and decided to become its own brokerage. That brokerage, obviously licensed under the state of Minnesota, is a completely different entity than a team being just a subsidiary of an existing brokerage. So they became a new real estate brokerage. Mr. Colson then was asked to join and did in fact join Bright Birch, the brokerage, and signed a independent contractor agreement with them. Now, the thrust of the case here is the application of the team agreement from 2017 that Mr. Colson signed with Bright Birch, the team, and whether or not it has any application to his dealings with Bright Birch, the brokerage.
Before we jump into the language of the two contracts, and I think you can assume that that we're familiar with the facts of the case from here on out. But before we dive in, I would like to ask about the status of the commission with regard to the 40th Lane property, because there's been some suggestion that has been paid, and the record is just really not clear on that. Has that been paid?
It's an amount of the commission has been paid. Obviously, a dispute still exists about the amount of that commission. So the amount that was paid was the one that was determined based upon the application of the team portion as well as the 98-2.
So the argument with respect to the 40th Lane Commission is the same as the other arguments that are being made, that that it's inconsistent with the contract that should have applied and shouldn't have applied.
Yes.
Okay, you may proceed. Thank you. Okay.
So that leads us to the issue of the application of the 2017 in this form. It is our position that the application of the 2017 agreement simply should not exist. I mean, that agreement assumed that Remax was the affiliated broker. There is absolutely no acknowledgement or definition or even statement by any party in these proceedings that it was assumed that Bright Birch somehow would fill that void of being an affiliated broker. Now, remember,
I think one thing I'd like you to address, and one of my concerns here, is the plain language of the brokerage contract, which indicates that it does not affect the teams. How do you get around that problem?
And it's fairly simple, because if you read the provision that what I refer to as the survival clause, it says that if the parties have entered into an existing team agreement. Now, they haven't. Bright Birch, the entity with the team, Bright Birch, the brokerage, was not the entity that entered into the team agreement with Mr. Colson. Those are two separate entities. In fact, you know, so there is that survival clause only would apply is if Bright Birch, the brokerage, had a separate team, Bright Birch team, and that Mr. Colson had entered into it while at Bright Birch brokerage. Now, in addition,
Mr. McGee, the brokerage agreement says it applies. It says this agreement supersedes any prior written or oral agreements between the parties, except any existing team member agreements. So why wouldn't the 2017 agreement be an existing team member agreement, given that it included Noel Nielsen and Mr. Colson?
Number one is there is the team agreement from 2017 was between Bright Birch, DBA Bright Birch Group, okay, and Mr. Colson. That is not the same entity that we have here. This is.
Would you agree it is a team agreement? The 2017 agreement is a team agreement.
Oh yes, it is a team agreement. But
why isn't it an existing team member agreement?
Because the survival clause says between the parties, and the
doesn't say between the parties though. Where do I find that language? I guess I'm missing that.
Yes, it's an existing team agreement between the parties. That's what, you know, and I don't have it in front of me right here. But I'd like to address another point, and I hear what you're saying.
Oh, you're okay. I see the next sentence says any existing team member agreement between the parties. So you're saying the parties are not the same?
Not the same parties.
Okay, can you explain that to me again?
Yeah, because the team agreement was between Bright Birch Inc., DBA Bright Birch Group. That was the team agreement in 2017. That is not a brokerage's name. The brokerage would go Bright Birch Inc., Bright Birch Real Estate. And now I know it's semantical in some sense, but the reality is these agreements are with different parties. And counsel has made a point, I mean, respondents have made a point saying that there's a difference between these entities, especially when arguing the whole affiliation issue. But in addition, okay, the flaws in the team agreement, that is not defining affiliate, not having inconsistent terms as to compensation, are not saved by the survival clause. The problems with the 2017 agreement are not cured just because you say, oh, it applies, because it's inconsistent with the independent contractor agreement. It's inconsistent in and of itself by not defining who the affiliated broker is. It's inconsistent because it doesn't provide a way for Mr. Colson to earn commissions. So even if we want to say it applies in 2000 to this relationship with Bright Birch Inc., it still has its flaws. And we have to look at those flaws, because those flaws are impacting the ability of Mr. Colson to earn commissions. Under both agreements, okay, there is provisions which basically say you have to, if you are terminated like Mr. Colson was, you have to continue to work on the transaction. Those provisions are inherently unenforceable. You can't enforce that, because as a real estate agent, I only can work for one broker. And if I get terminated by that broker, I can't continue to work with them. Number two is, there's contracts in this case, the Polks have with Bright Birch. If I'm a real estate agent with a different brokerage, I cannot interfere or approach those individuals to work with them, because they are under contract with a different brokerage. And so both these agreements provide a mechanism by which Mr. Colson would never be able to get a commission. Never. Once he's terminated, he is out of luck.
But I'll just point out here, he was able to obtain commissions with respect to two of the properties that we're talking about here. The concern that I understand is that the commissions were not satisfactory, because they were governed by both of these agreements instead of just one of these agreements. So I mean, technically, and maybe I'm incorrect here, but technically it's not accurate to say he was unable to obtain commissions after termination of the relationship, right?
The two commissions of which you speak, which I think is 40th and it's the White Bear Avenue, those were completed transactions. So it was just a matter of the check coming, okay? There was no additional work that he had to do. They were just monies that were coming to him. With the Brookwood transaction, they're saying you didn't get the commission because you didn't take it through to closing. That's different, because they're saying you had some additional work you needed to do to get it to closing. I can't do that.
Aren't they really saying that you don't get the commission because you weren't the agent? There wasn't an agreement.
That's two separate issues. Now, number one is a customer's agreement to be represented is with the brokerage, not with the agent, number one. Number two is, if there isn't a mechanism under the agreements for me to receive a commission, we go to procuring cause. That's procuring cause is the mechanism by which we determine what was my participation in earning that commission. What did I do to effectuate that? Now, that's a fact issue on itself, because it depends on what did I do in relation to somebody else. And the trial court made a determination on procuring cause without basically siding with the respondent and not giving my client, Mr. Colson, the benefit of the fact that all the interpretation of the facts go in his favor, and in fact, basically made a factual determination about my client's involvement in that transaction, which I think is, with all respect, factually inaccurate. So I think it's important that we focus on what is a fact issue here. And if we assume for sake of discussion that there is an ambiguity in the agreements, which I think is pretty clear, there is, because of the inconsistencies in affiliated broker with payments, with all that, then we get to fact issues. And that's
can I just ask you your argument, and I do want to hear about allegations about fact issues are certainly, but is the only ambiguity here the what you're claiming to be the inconsistency between the two agreements? In other words, if we just look at one agreement at a time, is there ambiguity? And can you point to any particular ambiguity in the 2017 agreement and any particular ambiguity in the 2018 agreement that you're concerned about?
Number one is both agreements are entirely, there's several inconsistencies, meaning different provisions when looking at them together.
Okay, but what if we look at them individually as individual contracts? Where are the ambiguities in each agreement?
The ambiguity with respect to 2017 is pretty clear. It defines that Mr. Colson has to do work for the team and the affiliated broker. That is it. That is because nobody knows who that affiliated broker is after he leaves Remax. Who is it? In this case, is it Bright Birch? Well, Mr. Colson did an affidavit in this case saying, I didn't know this agreement was going to follow me around. I didn't know that Bright Birch was, that I'm going to get stuck with paying Bright Birch, the same entity, two separate commission scales. So it's ambiguous there. It's also ambiguous regarding the commission splits are completely different. Which one applies? I mean, and number two is what happens when I'm terminated? And that applies to both. Now the 2018 one, that's the one we think should apply. That's got a 98-2 split. That was the one he signed when he joined Bright Birch, the brokerage. That's the one should apply. And the ambiguity in that one goes back to the issue of what do I do when I'm terminated? How do I continue to work when I can't work on this transaction because I'm not affiliated with Bright Birch anymore? Now, if the facts in this case are demonstrably demonstrate that Mr. Colson was terminated on the eve of receiving a large commission. He was terminated contrary to the provisions of the 2017 agreement, which says you need to terminate and give me 7 days notice. They terminated and gave him 2 days notice. And then as a result, on the eve of it, the trial court made determinations that Mr. Colson didn't do some work after the purchase agreement was signed, despite the fact that he was terminated. The court says we didn't do any post-purchase agreement stuff or didn't take it to closing. Well, he was fired. He was fired on the eve of this transaction. He was fired on the eve of getting this commission that he would have been able to do. And he was fired for reasons contrary. Now, I'd like to point out that there was, the judge made some determination, and again, with respect, that Nicole Nielsen was the agent for Mr. Polk, that Mr. Travis Colson was not. Now, that is inherently incorrect. If you look at the facts, the Polks contacted Travis Colson. They didn't contact Ms. Nielsen. They contacted him. They contacted him and he worked with them. He contacted him and he showed them the property. talked about the purchase agreement, did all that work, of which any real estate transaction, if you can secure the party to be, bring in the transaction and leave that person to a purchase agreement, you're going to get the commission, because that is what a real estate agent does, get that people to that position. The fact that the judge made a determination, I think, contrary to the facts of the case, and made a determination on procuring cause, which is by itself a fact issue, I think is improper.
Mr. McGee, is there? Yes. Can you point us to language in the brokerage agreement that supports your position that if you bring the client in, you get the commission?
Yeah, it says it right there. It says, my role here is to solicit work and to bring those clients to getting a transaction. Now, remember, there's two separate issues. I earn the commission, okay, when I secure the client and get a purchase agreement. The commission's not paid out till closing, but I've done what I need to do as a real estate agent when I solicit and secure those clients and get that purchase agreement signed. So, and in this case, what I'm asking is that we get the fact finder to make the determination if Mr. Coulson earned the commission or if Ms. Nielsen earned the commission. That's what we're asking for. We're not asking for a determination that he should get it. We're asking for our day in court. That's what we're asking for. So thank you. I'm out of time.
At this time, we'll hear from counsel for respondent. Please introduce yourself for the record before beginning your argument.
May it please the court, counsel, your honors, good morning. My name is Seth Nielsen. I represent the respondent, Bright Birch, and we appreciate the court's time here today. It sounds like the court is already quite familiar with the facts, and I think Mr. McGee explained the background accurately in the sense that Mr. Coulson was an agent on Bright Birch's team, and then he became an agent at Bright Birch's brokerage. And obviously, the second agreement that he signed with the brokerage preserved and acknowledged that the earlier team agreement would remain in full force and effect. That's really the thrust of their argument, is that the first agreement should no longer be in place. And what's so interesting about this agreement is that this issue was never raised while Mr. Coulson was at the brokerage. He waited until after he left to then go back and argue retrospectively that he should never have been treated as if he were on the team. The reality, though, is that there really can be no question that he was on the team. It's interesting that Mr. McGee's arguments have shifted back today largely to what he argued before the district court. Before the district court, they argued that the term affiliated broker in the first team agreement could only mean one person or one entity, and that was the broker that was in place at the time that the team agreement was signed. That's what they argued to the district court, and the district court said that they were not going to create an automatic termination provision, that the parties clearly had not included that in the agreement, and that the court was not going to insert that. In their brief, though, Mr. Coulson took a different position, and he attempted to define the term affiliated. They argued a completely different argument and said, effectively, now on appeal, anybody could be the affiliated broker. It just couldn't be Bright Birch. And their rationale behind that was, if they looked at dictionary definitions, they argued that to be affiliated required two separate entities. They argued that Bright Birch wasn't two separate entities, which again is curious because Mr. McGee today was arguing that when we look at the survival clause, that Bright Birch is two separate entities. So they've just advanced a number of conflicting provisions. And the reality is that there are no restrictions in the agreement, in the team agreement, that limit who can be the affiliated broker. It's not disputed that to be a licensee as a real estate agent in the state of Minnesota, you have to be affiliated with a broker. You have to have a relationship with a broker. You can't go out and provide real estate services by yourself. And so that is what we see in the team agreement. The parties to the team agreement had to be associated with a broker. And the agreement refers to the affiliated broker. Sometimes it refers to the party's broker. Sometimes it refers to the acting broker. But there's no dispute that there has to be one broker and there can only be one broker. So there's no question about who the broker is. And they haven't argued that there can be any legitimate dispute when you look at the agreement with respect to any point in time. There's no question that RE/MAX.
Mr. Nielsen, I'm wondering if you could address the argument made by your opposing counsel that there's a genuine issue of material fact as to the participation of Mr. Coulson in the that final transaction?
Sure, I'd be happy to address that. There are no disputes, I would argue, with respect to the facts in this case. The facts are all clearly set forth in the record, and you know, Breitbirch has acknowledged what Mr. Coulson did, and he's stated what he did. So with respect to the third transaction, the Brookwood transaction, it's not disputed. The record is quite clear that the clients, the Polks, had reached out to Mr. Coulson to show them some homes, and he did that. Not the Brookwood house, but some other houses. The facts also show that when Mr. Polk, the client, wanted to look at the Brookwood property, he reached out to Ms. Nielsen. There's phone records that show that, and Mr. Polk testified to that. And what's important to remember in this case, too, is that the Polks had already found the Brookwood home. Mr. Coulson didn't help them find the house. They had worked with another realtor at a different brokerage before and had actually made an offer on the Brookwood house before. And the other agent and the Polks weren't able to get the job done. With respect to the Brookwood property, when it came time to look at that property, it's not disputed that Ms. Nielsen and Mr. Coulson went to the showing. It's not disputed that after the showing, there was a phone call with the listing agent. It's not disputed that Mr. Coulson was on that phone call. It's also not disputed in the record that Mr. Coulson did not actively participate in that phone call. Now, I will note, when you read Mr. Coulson's brief, there is an inconsistency. They argued on page 19 of the reply brief, and they also argued in their opening brief, that Mr. Coulson discussed with the listing agent some ways to get the deal done. That's not what the record says. They're citing to Ms. Nielsen's deposition transcript. I think they cite to page 63 or something close to that. And if you actually read the transcript, it says that the listing agent had called and had wanted to speak about some ideas. He had either left a message or left a text message. And if you jump to page 90 or 91 of the transcript, Ms. Nielsen explains that they both called that listing agent back and explained what Mr. Coulson did and said on the call. Mr. Coulson started off the call saying, "Hey, Daniel," that's the name of the listing agent, "Hey, Daniel, what's up, brother?" And then the testimony says that Ms. Nielsen immediately took over the call. She didn't think that he was handling it appropriately for this level of the transaction. It's not disputed. And it's also not disputed that Ms. Nielsen did effectively everything after that. There's documentation of the draft of the offer that she prepared. It's not disputed that she sent it to the client and she also sent it to Mr. Coulson. They argue that Mr. Coulson was approving that draft, although there's nothing to really support that. That's kind of a characterization, but everybody acknowledges that Ms. Nielsen sent it to him. And it's not disputed that Ms. Nielsen did literally everything after that. She prepared the purchase agreement. She fostered the transaction through a 2 to 2.5 month period of dealing with contingencies, specifically the inspection contingency, that she negotiated that, including $80,000+ of repairs for the property. Mr. Coulson wasn't involved in any of that. And obviously Ms. Nielsen had the agreements with the clients. The record shows the client reached out to Ms. Nielsen on the day that he wanted to make the offer. The phone records show that it was not Ms. Nielsen reaching out, trying to convince the client not to work with Mr. Coulson. It was the client reaching out to Ms. Nielsen. None of that is subject to dispute. It's all in the record.
So there's been some suggestion, I think in the briefs and definitely today, that there may be a factual question about whether Ms. Nielsen somehow made it impossible for Mr. Coulson to comply with the contractual terms that would have required him to remain with the transaction through closing. Could you address whether there's any factual issue with regard to that particular issue that's been raised?
There is no issue. And I think the court asked Mr. McGee about whether Mr. Coulson was actually allowed to keep working on other transactions. The reality is, when he left the brokerage, he had two transactions. He had the White Bear transaction and the 40th Lane transaction. Mr. McGee said that they were both completed transactions, and that's not the case. The record shows that the White Bear transaction didn't close until a day or two or three after Mr. Coulson left the brokerage. And the White Bear, the 40th Lane transaction, didn't close for almost a month and a half after Mr. Coulson left the brokerage. He had no trouble continuing on with those transactions, and he was paid. The issue with respect to the Brookwood property is not really anything that Ms. Nielsen did. It's just the fact that the client had chosen to work with her rather than with Mr. Colson. If Mr. Colson had obtained them as a client, and if he had been working with them actively, and if he had been negotiating the deal, he would have just continued on with the deal. Ms. Nielsen didn't do anything to preclude him from doing that. And in fact, the record shows she even offered to let the deal go with Mr. Colson to his new brokerage if that's what the client really wanted. The facts are that there was nothing precluding him from working with the clients other than the client's decision that he wasn't going to be their agent. You know, the facts show from the very beginning.
So with regard to the Brookwood property and the brokerage agreement, when is a real estate salesperson entitled to a commission under the agreement? Is there a fact question as to whether appellant is entitled to a commission under the agreement?
There's not a fact question because, again, the requirements of the agreement are pretty clear. He has to have.
And what language in the agreement provides for when a real estate agent is entitled to a commission?
Well, as sort of a preliminary matter, the agreements themselves only apply to Mr. Colson's transactions. So there's no argument in this case that Mr. Colson completed a purchase agreement or handled any aspects of the transaction. We acknowledge that he went on a showing, but so did Ms. Nielsen. We acknowledge that he was on a phone call, but so was Ms. Nielsen, and Ms. Nielsen actually handled the call. So when you look at the agreement, nothing in this agreement indicates that Mr. Colson would get paid a commission for somebody else's transaction. If you look at paragraph 8, for example, of the brokerage agreement, it does require that the agents complete the file and provide all the paperwork for the file to the brokers before they get paid anything. That's one example of something that Mr. Colson didn't do. Now, even while he was at the brokerage, he could have prepared a purchase agreement, but he didn't do that because it was handled completely by a different agent. That's just one example. All of the commissions that are commissions earned or not earned on that particular agent's transaction. Mr. Colson wasn't the only agent at the brokerage. If another agent had a transaction, nothing in this agreement purports to provide that Mr. Colson would get a commission. And if you look at the team agreement, and if you look to the appendix A, it starts off saying that the gross commission that's going to be split, it's being calculated from the team member's real estate transaction. So it's not applying to other people's transactions. It's only to the team member's transaction themselves.
And so just so that I'm super clear about how this team thing works. So I guess one of the benefits, and correct me if I'm wrong, of being on the team is that you do get to share in the commissions from various transactions. I mean, is that where the portion that goes to the team goes? Does it go to all of the team members?
That's a good question. So the benefit, the sharing provision is really money going back to the team in exchange for some support or services that are provided. So if you look at the Brightbirch team agreement, one of the big benefits to the team member is that the team, Brightbirch or Noelle Nielsen, the lead agent, provide the team members with leads. So if you know, for example, this isn't really part of the record, but the team might get leads from Zillow or from Realtor.com. Those are paid leads. So that's just an example of a benefit. If you look at the agreement, it also says that the team will provide transaction specific support. So as Mr. Colson is working through a transaction, the team is there to provide the necessary support. Those are the types of things that are provided. And then in exchange, the team keeps a portion of the commission. And that then, goes to the team, not to the agents, but to the team.
Okay. And then with regard to the commission split with the brokerage, does the brokerage portion of the commission conceivably goes to a completely different purpose, such as holding the license and those kinds of things? Is that accurate as well?
That's accurate. If you look at the brokerage agreement, they're going to have different expenses that are being paid for. One of the big ones is you can see that the brokerage provides office space and shared office space is one of the things that's provided under the brokerage agreement. That's a significant expense. So that's part of what the brokerage commission is used to pay for.
So your opposing counsel has argued that the commission splits in the two agreements are inconsistent. Is there any inconsistency in your mind between those two agreements, or do they govern sort of completely different things? And does the money go to completely different things?
There's no inconsistency because they're two completely separate agreements for two completely separate purposes. So the team agreement has a commission split for team services, and the brokerage agreement has a different split for brokerage services. So they're just two different agreements. Just like Mr. Colson had back at RE/MAX, he had a team agreement and a brokerage agreement. It's the same thing, only now Brightbridge was also the brokerage. Just briefly, before I'm out of time, I just want to reiterate on the procuring cause claim. The district court dismissed the claim, not on the facts. It dismissed the claim as a matter of law and said that in this case, Mr. Colson doesn't get to use equitable remedies because they're not permitted when the parties have a contract. That's the Southtown plumbing case and the U.S. fire case. Mr. Colson's remedies and the scope of his remedies are dictated by his contract. And he didn't do the things he needed to do under his contract to obtain a commission for the Brookwood transaction. And frankly, there's no case law that supports that this particular cause of action extends to interbrokerage disputes, nor would an agent have standing to even assert these claims because, again, without their contract, they're not entitled to any commissions. They're only entitled to commissions through their broker as permitted by a contract. So that wasn't a fact issue. And again, the facts are very clear. The court just said, even if you look at the facts, it's still clear that Mr. Colson was not and could not have been the procuring cause based upon the case law. I'm out of time. We really appreciate the court's time. We respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, Mr. McGee, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You'll need to unmute.
Just still getting used to it. I'd like to focus on this team. Now remember, at Brightbridge, when Mr. Colson is there in 2018, they're the same entity. I mean, they're basically the brokerage and the team. Now, counsel went through telling us all about the difference between a team, and none of that's in the record. Those are all fact issues that would have to be bared out at trial. And so the idea that somehow we're going to make a distinction in the team agreement that's for team activities and the brokerage is for brokerage, there's absolutely nothing in the record to support that. Nothing at all. In addition.
Well, let me just interrupt you there because don't the contracts touch on those issues?
Remember, you're talking about a 2017 contract was when he was with RE/MAX, and RE/MAX was, and this team agreement was separate and distinct because RE/MAX had its own agreement with Mr. Colson. Now you're switching it back to Brightbridge and saying you're the same entity and you have this one agreement that Mr. Colson signed in 2018 when he joined you. And now we're going to slide in this 2017 that Mr. Colson says he didn't know this was applying to him. There's no facts that he got extra benefits in the 2017 agreement when he was at Brightbridge. There's absolutely no facts to support that. That's just a slide-in agreement to take more money out of Mr. Colson's pocket. There is no testimony whatsoever he got any benefit for that contract or that he was informed that it would apply. And so the idea that somehow we're going to say, oh, that's what the contract says. Well, Mr. Colson provided an affidavit saying, I didn't know this contract was going to provide, keep on coming after I left RE/MAX because it was an agreement entered into when he was at RE/MAX. In addition, let's be absolutely clear. The Brookwood, the Polks would not be a client of Brightbridge if it wasn't for Mr. Colson. He was the one that was contacted, not Ms. Nielsen. He was the one that was contacted. He was the one that was spoken to first. He was involved in everything. But again, these are fact issues. Why are we making this determination now? Why did the trial court make that determination when procuring cause is a fact issue? And all also understand is that the purchase agreement was entered into by the Polks for the property when Mr. Colson was out of the office. Okay, He was on a vacation. Everyone knew it. Ms. Nielsen came in and go, you want me to handle any part of your transactions while you're gone? He goes, no, I can do it. In fact, he closed a transaction when he was on vacation. Ms. Nielsen refused to acknowledge his emails or his text messages about when he heard, not from Ms. Nielsen, from the closer, that there may be a purchase agreement on the transaction. He contacts her and goes, what's up? She then goes dark on him. He then returns, and 2 days after returning, she fires him. These are facts. So when you say he wasn't involved in the purchase agreement, or he was, it's because he wasn't allowed to. And those are facts that we have to make that determination on based on the fact finder, not based upon an interpretation now, especially an interpretation by the judge, with respect, that I think she interpreted the facts in favor of Breitbirch instead of in favor of Mr. Coulson. Now, the contracts that my client had says he only has to do the following to earn his commission. It says, work diligently and with his best efforts to sell, lease, or rent any and all real estate listed or under contract with Breitbirch, and to solicit additional listings and clients for purposes of effectuating real estate transactions. That's in the contract. That's what he's obligated to do. And so we make the determination of procuring causes, who is the reason that transaction closed? And there is no, there's no factual dispute that Mr. Coulson is the reason that client is even there. Second, the client doesn't get to dictate procuring cause. The client doesn't get to dictate, you know what? Two agents, same brokerage. I met this guy. I like this guy. I want him to have the commission. Sorry, that's not determination that's made. Then also, the agreements that clients entered in, the Polks enter into, is with the brokerage, not with an agent. So the idea that somehow, oh, we have a signed agreement. No, the brokerage has a signed agreement. And at the time of the purchase agreement, Mr. Coulson was an agent at that brokerage, just like Ms. Nielsen was. So the idea that somehow he gets some sort of, she gets some sort of leg up because there's an agreement, it's, they both have the benefit of that agreement. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. And thank you for the questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you to both the attorneys for your briefing, arguments, and answering our questions this morning. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days as required by statute. That concludes the Court of Appeals oral arguments this morning. The panel will now attend to its non-oral calendar. Thank you.
Thank you.